Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
From the Jill Schwartz Memorial Library here in sultry Savannah, Georgia, this is Obscure Season 4 in American Tragedy. I'm your host, your friend, your ear lover, and literary mansplainer-in-chief, Michael Ian Black, returned from tour. The state tour has now concluded. Happily, I will add, I'm not necessarily happy that it's over, just it concluded happily. We had a happy conclusion. Two shows, one in Nashville, one in Austin. Both were good fun, and now that is done. My sister-in-law is visiting this week, my wife's younger sister, so that'll be nice to have her here for a few days, and then on, Monday, I go to Atlanta to conclude shooting the movie that I'm in. That will probably be out, I would guess, next summer. So, you know, that catches you up to my comings and goings. Was a good time after, well, I guess I neglected a coming and going, because after Austin, I did go to LA for a couple of days to visit my daughter and to play in a charity poker tournament in which I did terribly. It didn't matter. You know, it's charity. What do I care, right? I care. Obviously, I care very much. But I knew some people there, which was fun. I sat next to my poker friend, Maria Ho, who I once took a, what am I going to say? Was it a $100,000 pot from? Yeah, it was. But you'll find out all about that at some future point. Anyway, now I'm back. I'm here to read a book, I guess, to you, An American Tragedy. I mean, that is the book we have been slowly digesting over low these past many months. And last time I thought was kind of interesting. They introduced this new character, Walter Dillard, I believe is his name, who has the makings of a grifter, I think. Somebody who's just pawing and clawing and trying to ingratiate himself with Clyde because he thinks Clyde will help him ascend society's ladder. I mean, really, it's not that much different from what Clyde's doing, you know? We're all grifters in our way, are we not? We're all looking for an edge. It's just that some people do it a little more distastefully than others. It's one of the things that kind of drives me crazy, really, about this great nation of ours. And I use the term, or the adjective, I should say, great advisedly, because I am becoming less and less convinced of this nation's greatness. I'm not sure I ever was fully convinced, but less and less so as the years unfold. That does have a lot to do with the political climate in this nation, but it also has to do with a kind of fundamental orienting of priorities. And ever since, the founding, the nation's priorities have not exactly aligned with what I view as my own priorities. Not that I was alive at the nation's founding, but I think you know what I mean. And this problem, this intractable problem of the United States of America, I feel like has only gotten worse in the past, I'm going to say 40 years. It's really been about 40 years. I mean, maybe you could trace it back to, mid-60s, early 60s, when there was a sense of discontent in the nation as more and more people started advocating for the rights that they had been denied over the past previous centuries. And that seemed to unleash a hornet's nest, which has not abated. I mean, I don't know that a hornet's nest can abate. It's probably a poor way of phrasing it, but the problems that that unleashed, and in fact, they were problems that needed to be addressed, it has not come to any kind of satisfactory conclusion. In fact, it seems to be getting worse by the day. And so when I see a Clyde Griffiths or a Walter Dillard ambling along looking for their edge, it puts me on edge because I'm tired of it. I'm tired of the wheeling and dealing and grasping and hustling in my own life and also in the life of the nation. So that's kind of how I'm entering the picture this week as we begin a brand new chapter on Obscure, always my favorite way to begin an episode, with a new chapter, a new beginning, new possibilities, a new unfolding, a new wrinkle in the story. I cannot wait to see what happens. So why wait? Let's bring it on. Book 2, Chapter 27, An American Tragedy. So what just happened is Walter has ingratiated or is attempting to ingratiate himself with Clyde, and Clyde, recognizing that somebody is trying to perhaps finagle him, has withdrawn and said, thanks, but no thanks. I think I'm going to take a pass on the cigarettes and soda pop that you offered me. So let's begin. Here we go. Nevertheless, the next day being a Saturday and half holiday the year round in this concern, Mr. Wiggin came through with the pay envelopes. "There you are, Mr. Griffiths," he said, as though he were especially impressed with Clyde's position. Clyde, taking it, was rather pleased with this mistering, M-I-S-T-E-R-I-N-G, mistering. That's a word I don't know, so we've just begun, and yet I already have to crank up the old research machine. Open up those dusty Dewey Decimal System card catalog files and see. Mistering is, it's the present participle and gerund of mister. That doesn't help me at all. Mistering. Yeah, I mean, there doesn't seem to be a definition of it. All right, let's go to yourdictionary.com. Mistering, the present participle of mister. I don't understand what I'm looking at. I'm going to go do a further deeper dive. Mistering, an American tragedy. All right, let's see. Mistering. No, nothing. All right, well, I guess we'll skip it. It's very annoying. All right, so he was pleased with the mystery, and going back towards his locker, promptly tore it open and pocketed the money. After that, taking his hat and coat, he wandered off in the direction of his room, where he had his lunch. But being very lonely, and Dillard not being present because he had to work, he decided upon a trolley ride to Gloversville, which was a city of some 20,000 inhabitants and reported to be as active, if not as beautiful, as Lycurgus. And that trip amused and interested him because it took him into a city very different from Lycurgus in its social texture. And I want to point out that there is a typo. Oh, you know what? Well, let's see. So the typo that I think I see is misconstruing the words from and form. The word I see is form, but let's see if it does make sense as form. Because it took him into a city very different form Lycurgus in its social texture. No, that's a typo. But the next day, Sunday, he spent idly in Lycurgus, wandering about by himself. For as it turned out, Dillard was compelled to return to Fonda for some reason and could not fulfill the Sunday understanding. Right, they were going to go out, I think, and see some girls or something on Sunday. Encountering Clyde, however, on Monday evening, he announced that on the following Wednesday evening, in the basement of the Digby Avenue Congregational Church, there was to be held a social with refreshments. Wow. And according to young Dillard, at least this promised to prove worthwhile. I love a social with refreshments. You know, when I picture that, what am I picturing? A big bowl of punch and maybe some vanilla fingers and maybe some little sandwiches with parsley on top, and or I guess not on top. I'm imagining like a little sprig of parsley, and how nice that would be. Maybe some sliced tomatoes and butter, and maybe even a chocolate fountain. Who knows what kind of refreshments they're going to have there at the Digby Avenue Congregational Church. I'm reminded as I read about Clyde wandering lonely through the streets of Lycurgus. That's exactly how I used to be when I was a freshman at NYU. Probably a little younger than Clyde, but I remember all those lonely nights in New York when, you know, you had sort of a social life, but nobody was around and nobody was doing nothing, and you felt kind of lonesome out there by yourself in Greenwich Village. And so I'd, you know, put on my best army surplus pants and head out into the night, strolling the streets of Greenwich Village, Bleecker Street and Greenwich Avenue, and, you know, the Avenue of the Americas and all around there, head down to Soho. And I remember all those lonesome nights, just people watching, walking around, listening to music, getting a slice of pizza. That's how I imagine Clyde spending his time in Lycurgus. "Well, we can just go out there," was the way he put it to Clyde, "and buzz the girls a little. I want you to meet my uncle and aunt. They're nice people, all right, and so are the girls. They're no slouches. Then we can edge out afterwards, about 10, see, and go around to either Zella or Rita's place. Rita has more good records over at her place, but Zella has the nicest place to dance. By the way, you didn't chance to bring along your dress suit with you, did you?" he inquired. For having already inspected Clyde's room, which was above his own on the third floor, in Clyde's absence, and having discovered that he had only a dress suitcase and no trunk, and apparently no dress suit anywhere, he had decided that in spite of Clyde's father conducting a hotel and Clyde having worked in the Union League Club in Chicago, he must be very indifferent to social equipment, or if not, must be endeavoring to make his own way on some character-building plan without help from anyone. This was not to his liking, exactly. A man should never neglect these social essentials. Nevertheless, Clyde was a Griffiths, and that was enough to cause him to overlook nearly anything, for the present, anyhow. Okay, but I don't like that we're just glossing over the fact that Dillard just kind of wandered around Clyde's room when Clyde wasn't there and went through his stuff and looked through his knickknacks and looked for his dress suit and everything else. I mean, Clyde doesn't have anything worth stealing, but by God, man, have some sense of propriety. Yes, you're living in a boarding house together. That doesn't give you the right to go into whoever's room you want anytime you want. I don't like that at all, Walter Dillard. That is a flaw in your character. But I think we already assume Walter's character is flawed, so perhaps we should not be entirely surprised. "No, I didn't," replied Clyde, who was not exactly sure as to the value of this adventure, even yet, in spite of his own loneliness. "But I intend to get one." He had already thought, since coming here, of his lack in this respect, and was thinking of taking at least 35 of his more recently hard-earned savings and indulging in a suit of this kind. Well, here, I'm not sure I fully understand here, because we know that Clyde was a dandy back in Kansas City, right? He had procured from himself all kinds of finery in the sartorial department, and then he absconded to Chicago. We know that, so it's possible he left all of his good haberdashery back there in Kansas City, But once he was in Chicago and working in a similar position and probably making the same kind of money he was making in Kansas City, why didn't he procure for himself more such things? You know, you can imagine him getting himself a couple of suits, some fine suits and some ties and some shoes and all the rest of it. But apparently he did not. And I don't quite understand that. Dillard buzzed on about the fact that while Zella Schumann's family wasn't rich, they owned the house they lived in, still, she went with a lot of nice girls here too. So did Rita Dickerman. Zella's father owned a little cottage upon Eckert Lake near Fonda. When next summer came, and with it the holidays and pleasant weekends, he and Clyde, supposing that Clyde liked Rita, might go up there sometime for a visit. For Rita and Zella were inseparable, almost. And they were pretty, too.
Back on Obscure.
Zella's dark and Rita's light, he added enthusiastically. Well, so what do we know about Fonda? Is Fonda where What's-Her-Face is trying to get them to buy the beach house? It's hard to remember when you go week after week, you know, and you're reading this book as slowly as I am. It's hard to remember. But the idea of the lake and the lake house and all the comings and goings there and all the fun that young people are having out by the lake, I mean, it does spell some portentous adventuring, does it not? I think we are foreshadowing some misadventure that's going to happen up there in Fonda. Clyde was interested by the fact that the girls were pretty, yeah, as you should be, and that out of a clear sky and in the face of his present loneliness, he was being made so much of by this Dillard. But was it wise for him to become very much involved with him? That was the question. For after all, he really knew nothing of him. And he gathered from Dillard's manner, his flighty enthusiasm for the occasion, that he was far more interested in the girls as girls, a certain freedom or concealed looseness that characterized them, than he was in the social phase of the world which they represented. And wasn't that what brought about his downfall in Kansas City? Here in Lycurgus, of all places, he was least likely to forget it, aspiring to something better, as he now did. So Clyde at least is self-aware enough to know that Dillard is potentially bringing him into a viper's nest, and he needs to watch his every step, lest he get bit. All right, let's take a break for a moment, and then we shall return.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So So Clyde and is thinking about these girls and thinking about Dillard, and but he can't help himself. He's lonely. He wants to socialize. And why didn't his uncle think of this? And why hasn't his uncle invited him over for a weekend supper or something? I mean, it seems very rude, does it not? His uncle doesn't even introduce him to his own family. I mean, that sucks. Doesn't that suck? I feel like that sucks. You know what? That sucks. Nonetheless, at 8:30 on the following Wednesday evening, they were off, Clyde full of eager anticipation. And by 9 o'clock, they were in the midst of one of those semi-religious, semi-social, and semi-emotional church affairs, the object of which was to raise money for the church, the general service of which was to furnish an occasion for gossip among the elders, criticism, and a certain amount of enthusiastic, if disguised, courtship and flirtation among the younger members. There were booths for the sale of quite everything, from pies, cakes, and ice cream to laces, dolls, and knickknacks of every description supplied by the members and parted with for the benefit of the church. The Reverend Peter Israels, the minister, and I'm pronouncing it Israels purposely because it's spelled Israel as opposed to Israel. Israel. Israels, the minister, and his wife were present. Also Dillard's uncle and aunt, a pair of brisk and yet uninteresting people whom Clyde could sense were of no importance socially here. They were too genial and altogether social in the specific neighborhood sense, although Grover Wilson, being a buyer for Stark & Company, endeavored to assume a serious and important air at times. I guess he's related to them through his aunt, and the husband, the uncle, must be Grover Wilson. All right, fine. He was an undersized, here we go again. This is just a theme with Dreiser. It's about height. Height, 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 as some sort of indication of worth and perhaps social status, because he was undersized and stocky man who did not seem to know how to dress very well or could not afford it. In contrast to his nephew's almost immaculate garb, his own suit was far from perfect fitting. It was unpressed and slightly soiled, and his tie the same. He had a habit of rubbing his hands in a clerkly fashion. What is a clerkly fashion? What does that even mean? How does a clerk rub their hands? I guess I'm imagining sort of wringing your hands as if you're washing them under a sink, you know, just sort of nervous wringing of hands, a rubbing of palms together, an interlacing of fingers. That's how I'm imagining a clerkly fashion of wrinkling his brows and scratching the back of his head at times, as though something he was about to say had cost him great thought and was of the utmost importance, whereas nothing that he uttered, as even Clyde could see, was of the slightest importance. Gosh, I mean, that's just mean. Dreiser has a mean streak, doesn't he? I mean, he's always describing people as homely and undersized and denigrating their importance in the world, and he's just kind of a snob. I mean, it's hard to say that he's a snob because, again, and I like this about Dreiser, it's hard exactly to know where his sympathies lie. We believe them to lie with the underclass, but that's not necessarily the case because he doesn't have a great deal of good things to say about these poor wretches serving in middle management positions. My God, the embarrassment. And so, too, with the stout and large Mrs. Wilson, who stood beside him while he was attempting to rise to the importance of Clyde. She merely beamed a fatty beam. It's a very good sentence. Again, it's a mean sentence, but it... A fatty beam. I like that. She was almost ponderous and pink with a tendency to a double chin. She smiled and smiled, largely because she was naturally genial and on her good behavior here, but incidentally because Clyde was who he was. For as Clyde himself could see, Walter Dillard had lost no time in impressing his relatives with the fact that he was a Griffiths. Also, that he had encountered and made a friend of him, and that he was now chaperoning him locally. "Walter's been telling us that you've just come on here to work for your uncle. You're Mrs. Cuppy's now, I understand. I don't know her, but I've always heard she keeps such a nice, refined place. Mr. Parsley, who lives here with her, used to go to school with me, but I don't see much of him anymore. Did you meet him yet?"
"No, I didn't," said Clyde in return.
"Well, you know, we expected you last Sunday to dinner. Only Walter had to go home." Oh, that's what was happening last Sunday at dinner, the aunt and uncle's, not girly time. "Only Walter had to go home. But you must come soon, any time at all. I would love to have you." Oh, now here I've been reading it as Mr. Wilson, but in fact this was Mrs. Wilson the whole time. So I'm just going to reread the last paragraph as I beam a fatty beam. "Well, you know, we expected you last Sunday to dinner. Only Walter had to go home. But you must come soon, any time at all. I would love to have you." She beamed and her small grayish-brown eyes twinkled. Clyde could see that because of the fame of his uncle, he was looked upon as a social find, really. And so it was with the remainder of this company, old and young. The Reverend Peter Israels and his wife, Mr. Micah Bumpus. I mean, you can't fault the naming of characters here, can you? I mean, you got a reverend named Israels, and you've got a local called Bumpus, who's a local vendor of printing inks, and his wife and son, Mr. and Mrs. Maximilian Pick. Mr. Pick being a wholesale and retail dealer in hay, grain, and feed. And how do you obtain hay, grain, and feed? You pick it. And that's why he is called Pick. Mr. Witness, a florist, and Mrs. Throop, a local real estate dealer. All knew Samuel Griffiths and his family by reputation, and it seemed not a little interesting and strange to all of them that Clyde, a real nephew of so rich a man, should be here in their midst. The only trouble with this was that Clyde's manner was very soft and not as impressive as it should be, not so aggressive and contemptuous, and most of them were of that type of mind that respects insolence even where it pretends to condemn it. That, I think, is an excellent observation of human behavior. And it jives with something I was reading the other day, or just yesterday, I feel like on the plane ride home, about advice for negotiating and how you sometimes just have to be a prick. You know, and that when you're a prick, when you're negotiating, it doesn't mean that people aren't going to like you when the negotiations are done. In fact, it means the opposite. They may respect you more because people of the human type are often of the type of mind that respects insolence, even when it pretends to condemn it. We can look to our politics for evidence of such. Insofar as the young girls were concerned, it was even more noticeable, for Dillard was making this important relationship of Clyde's perfectly plain to everyone. "This is Clyde Griffiths, the nephew of Samuel Griffiths, Mr. Gilbert Griffith's cousin, you know. He's just come on here to study the collar business in his uncle's factory." And Clyde, who realized how shallow was this pretense, was still not a little pleased and impressed by the effect of it all. This Dillard's effrontery, the brassy way in which, because of Clyde, he presumed to patronize these people. On this occasion, he kept guiding Clyde here and there, refusing for the most part to leave him alone for an instant. In fact, he was determined that all whom he knew and liked among the girls and young men should know who and what Clyde was and that he was presenting him. Also, that those whom he did not like should see as little of him as possible, not be introduced at all. "She don't amount to anything. Her father only keeps a small garage here. I wouldn't bother with her if I were you." Or, "He isn't much around here, just a clerk in our store." At the same time, in regard to some others, he was all smiles and compliments, or at worst, apologetic for their social lacks. And then he was introduced to Zella Schumann and Rita Dickerman, who, for reasons of their own, not the least among which was a desire to appear a little wise and more sophisticated than the others here, came a little late. And it was true, as Clyde was to find out afterwards, that they were different. That they were different, too. Less simple and restricted than quite all of the girls whom Dillard had thus far introduced him to. They were not as sound religiously and morally as were these others. And how does he know that? I mean, I guess he'll find out later, as it says. And as even Clyde noted on meeting them, they were as keen for as close an approach to pagan pleasure, without admitting it to themselves, as it was possible to be and not be marked for what they were. My God, Dreiser, what are you doing? You're denigrating these women. And you're forcing your own editorial opinion of them onto us before we've had a chance to make up our minds. Don't go slut-shaming them. If you are, you got to slut-shame Walter Dillard, too. I don't care for that. I don't care for it at all. And in consequence, there was something in their manner, the very spirit of the introduction, which struck him as different from the tone of the rest of this church group. Not exactly morally or religiously unhealthy, but rather much freer, less repressed, less reserved than were these others. "Oh, so you're Mr. Clyde Griffiths," observed Zella Schumann. "My, you look a lot like your cousin, don't you? I see him driving down Central Avenue every so often. Walter has been telling us all about you. Do you like Lycurgus?" The way she said Walter, together with something intimate and possessive in the tone of her voice, caused Clyde to feel at once that she must feel rather closer to and freer with Dillard than he himself had indicated. A small scarlet bow of velvet ribbon at her throat, two small garnet earrings in her ears, a very trim and tight-fitting black dress with a heavily flounced skirt seemed to indicate that she was not opposed to showing her figure, and prized it, a mood which, except for a demure and rather retiring poise which she affected, would most certainly have excited comment in such a place as this. Rita Dickerman, on the other hand, was lush and blonde, with pink cheeks, light chestnut hair, and bluish-gray eyes. Lacking the aggressive smartness which characterized Zella Schumann, she still radiated a certain something which to Clyde seemed to harmonize with the liberal, if secret, mood of her friend. Her manner, as Clyde could see, while much less suggestive of masked bravado, was yielding, and to him designedly so, as well as naturally provocative. It had been arranged that she was to intrigue him. It had been arranged that she was to intrigue him, as if such a thing could be arranged, and in fact it could be. I mean, look, it doesn't take much to intrigue a boy of 22 or 23 or whatever age he is. Show a little ankle, wink a little wink, pinch your cheeks a touch, and chances are your object of prey will, in fact, be intrigued. Very much fascinated by Zella Schumann, and in tow of her, they were inseparable. And when Clyde was introduced to her, she beamed upon him in a melting and sensuous way, which troubled him not a little. For here in Lycurgus, as he was telling himself at the time, he must be very careful with whom he became familiar. And yet, unfortunately, as in the case of Hortense Briggs, she evoked thoughts of intimacy, however unproblematic or distant, which troubled him. But he must be careful. It was just such a free attitude as this suggested by Dillard, as well as these girls' manners, that had gotten him into trouble before. And I suppose we'll leave it there with the hint of trouble on the way. Trouble blowing in with the scent of their toilet as they arrive late to the church social. And we know from there, they're going to go to one of their homes and put on some records and probably cut a rug. So who knows where it will lead, but almost certainly no place good. For Zella and Rita and Walter are all in this for themselves, trying to gain that edge, which is so displeasing to me these days. So that'll do it. That's going to wrap us up on this episode of Obscure. I am anxiously awaiting to see what kind of tomfoolery and mix-em-ups these kids are going to get themselves into. You know, once you put on a Victrola record and you start dancing around, possibly even in stockinged feet, where stockinged feet are discovered, trouble is sure to find a foothold. And that was a pun, and I will leave it with that. So, we'll pick it up again on another, why don't we say quaint? Why don't we just go with simple old quaint on another quaint episode of Obscure? But until then, I wish you and yours an adieu. This season of Obscure is produced by me, Michael Ian Black, and Robin Lynn. Our theme music is by Craig Wedren. If you listen and like the show, please help us out with a rating and a review. We want to be obscure, but not that obscure. It's an easy way to support the show. Thanks.
Spring is in full bloom. Are your finances? With the Chime Secured Credit Builder Visa Credit Card, you can build credit with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments, all with no annual fees or interest. With Chime Secured Credit Card, you can start improving your credit scores right away. Get started today at chime.com/build. That's chime.com/build. Chime. Feels like progress.
The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal and OTC advance fees may apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.